progress. Most educational technology, she noted, has not even been demonstrably neutral. But critics who see an anti-teacher agenda counter that the improvement may have been due to instructors, perhaps motivated by the experiment, rather than to the technology. One no-frills online tutorial program, Khan Academy, shuns video game production values. Its original novelty was that the founder, a mathematically adept former investment banker, Salman Khan, is not a professional mathematician and may be closer to a beginner's point of view. His relatively crude production values fit the no-nonsense mood of the 2008 recession. Some students, using his thousands of online videos to understand concepts, rewarded by badges for completion in a way that would have gratified Skinner, have surpassed their classmates rapidly, and Khan is a Silicon Valley hero. In the philanthropic sweepstakes, Khan has the backing of one of the biggest donors, Bill Gates. But Khan's engagingly offhand method, first developed for tutoring a cousin, has drawbacks. Teachers have found significant errors, such as misleading treatment of negative numbers, and have doubted whether his tutorials create deep understanding or are just old-fashioned drill dressed up for a new generation. The limits of Khan Academy suggest another possibility. What if the instructor offering free online materials is a professional expert with a popular, acclaimed course? Isn't computer science itself at least suitable for a new and more efficient style of teaching that will contain ever-rising tuition and student debt? Would that not realize Edison's and Skinner's dreams for the future of education? The best-known MOOC, Massive Open Online Course, is the artificial intelligence course of Sebastian Thrun, now an adjunct professor of computer science at Stanford and an entrepreneur, previously on Stanford's tenured faculty and an executive and fellow of Google. By 2013, 7,500 people all over the world had successfully completed his MOOC, more than 12 years enrollment of the most popular course in his Stanford department. It is hard to apply concepts of efficiency to this result because 95% of people who had enrolled in the course had dropped out. This bothered Thrun, but does not concern another prominent computer scientist, Robert Sedgwick of Princeton, who, with his colleague Kevin Wayne, taught a highly popular conventional course on algorithms for decades, with a text used worldwide, before launching a MOOC. Remaining an enthusiast, Sedgwick finds that many supposed dropouts were in fact interested in only part of a course. The online course report website ranks Thrun's course as 40 out of 50, with 160,000 total enrollments, and Sedgwick and Wayne's Algorithms 1 as number 7, with over 751,000. Whatever the reasons for attrition, the MOOC dropout rate suggests that we are far from the Skinnerian ideal of an online tutor that could teach anything to anybody at their own pace. And there is an even more serious challenge to online teaching in achieving efficiency. From a public lecture that Sedgwick gave at Princeton and a telephone follow-up, I discovered that if you have to ask the cost of preparing a really good MOOC, you probably can't afford it. Sedgwick had extensive experience and student feedback, yet to give his online lectures pedagogically useful dynamic examples, he had to spend 50 to 100 hours for every instructional hour online, as opposed to Khan's improvisation of his early tutorials with little or no research. Edison had dreamed of replacing the 2% efficient textbook with 100% efficient film, but courses like Sedgwick's are difficult to follow and review without a text as reference. Sedgwick and Wayne's 992-page algorithms textbook had already sold 600,000 copies in four editions by 2013, and Sedgwick believes the MOOC has helped double the book's royalties. While MOOCs do make lectures by elite professors freely available, and some offer certification that can be an alternative to thousands of dollars in tuition, they really depend on wealthy institutions, even if most professors develop MOOCs on their own time. They are like freemium software that adds to demand for the full-price product. There is an ironic twist to the now century-old quest for educational efficiency through information technology. For all the practical problems in realizing it, Skinner's confidence in technological tutoring has never been refuted. Devices and the web are helpful, but only to a point. A recent study by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, has suggested that while moderate exposure is helpful, overinvestment in educational technology can actually harm outcomes. Students who spend the most time on electronic devices have lower mathematics scores, for example. The psychologist K. Anders Ericsson has described striking improvements in elite athletics and musicianship over the past century. Gains achieved mainly through better coaching and mindful practice, rather than through electronic devices. Because of findings like the OECD report, even many parents in information technology industries now believe that intensive screen time should be postponed in favor of more humanistic methods in early years. One of their favorite movements, the Waldorf schools, was founded almost 100 years ago by Thomas Edison's contemporary, the Austrian mystical philosopher Rudolf Steiner, who left a technical career to develop a pedagogical system based on the ideas of Goethe and Hindu spirituality. The religious basis of the school is no secret, nor is controversy over Steiner's ambiguous views on race. Yet the parents do not appear to be converts to the tenets of Steiner's system of anthroposophy, nor are most of its doctrines taught explicitly. The official website of the Waldorf movement defines anthroposophy as a spiritual philosophy that strives to bridge the clefts that have developed since the Middle Ages between the sciences, the arts, and the religious strivings of man. Rather, the parents seem to be pragmatists who believe in indirection. If real efficiency is the ability not just to plug variables into equations, but to solve unfamiliar problems creatively, then apparently inefficient methods may actually be most effective. And studies over decades suggest that test results of Waldorf students are at least as good as those of conventional schools. The point is not that Waldorf is superior, but that teacher concern with students as individuals is more important than technologies and spiritual beliefs alike. While the Waldorf schools share a unique quasi-religious philosophy that makes them unsuitable for public education, the Finnish school system has shown that human-based, individualized instruction does not need intensive technology. It relies on making teaching an elite profession, well-trained and well-paid, and encouraging teachers to work with students individually on their goals, giving teachers freedom to experiment and avoiding high-pressure testing. The paradoxical result of not obsessing over tests is that Finland's international educational assessment scores are some of the world's highest. Thanks to their nation's judicious use of computers in the classroom, adult Finns surpass Americans and Canadians significantly, not only in literacy and numeracy, but in tests of solving problems in technology-rich contexts. The United States, without the social solidarity of relatively homogeneous nations like Finland, and with a tradition of local support and control, faces a special problem created by technology: an increasing gap between richer and poorer schools. Just as the results of the Finnish schools are due more to teacher preparation and morale than to equipment, the extension of broadband computing to American schools has had little impact on the most serious inequality, the poor preparation of many teachers for using information technology effectively, and the lack of resources for continuing education of teachers in low-income school districts as wealthy ones forge ahead. The technology that promised to equalize students' opportunities appears to be increasing inequality. Whether schools are Waldorf or Jesuit, whether Japanese or Finnish, technology is still secondary to the selection, motivation, and training of teachers. This can't be cheap, because the people with the human and academic skills to be excellent elementary and secondary teachers are not common, and their teaching skills need time and expert supervision to develop. The most efficient course is to accept the inherent inefficiency of the process. Turning from the organization of instruction to students' personal technology, the decade from 2006 to 2016 saw a revolution in mobile computing that has changed the experience of school, the almost universal smartphone. By 2015, according to a Pew Foundation study, nearly three-quarters of American teenagers had smartphones, as did half of elementary school students by 2016. Other research found teenagers spending 9 hours a day on media using all devices. New York City schools attempted to ban smartphones. Students bringing them to school had to pay entrepreneurs to check them in trucks, but found the rule unenforceable. In the 1990s, Seymour Papert announced a goal of one laptop per child. Now, most children, even many from low-income families, have smartphones significantly more powerful than the laptops of the late 20th century, and schools don't know what to do about them. While information hardware has advanced more rapidly than even most technology prophets had expected, the all-digital lifestyle has not, especially in the schools. If you doubt this, consider pencil manufacturing. The graphite clay pencil, as we know it, has changed little over 200 years. In May 2016, Stationery News reported continued, if slow, 3% growth in the sale of pencils, pens, and other writing materials, many of which are bought as school supplies. It is possible to enter mathematical equations and chemical formulas and diagrams with special software, but in working out any problem or exercise, it is simply more efficient to sketch it with a pencil before calculating the results. Calculations are now always made with pocket calculators or software, yet paper laboratory notebooks remain the norm for schools, despite the growing popularity of software records among professional scientists. An idea from studies of culture is equally applicable to technological styles in education: omnivorousness. People's musical and artistic tastes, mixed in the mid-19th century when competing Shakespearean actors could inspire riots among fans, had become stratified into highbrow and lowbrow by late in the century, when a new decorum prevailed in elegant theaters and opera houses. In the 1990s, though, sociologists investigating Americans' tastes discovered that elites no longer identified exclusively with high culture. They also had interests in popular culture, and far from being embarrassed by them, believed in inclusiveness. The technology that transformed personal computing, the Macintosh, was itself a hybrid, omnivorous product influenced by Steve Jobs' extended study of calligraphy after dropping out of the degree program at Reed College. Electronic devices have not killed notebooks, pens, and pencils in the schools or elsewhere, for good reason. The inefficiency of paper can help people study and live more efficiently. Smartphones, in particular, are not just tools, but portals to a full range of media products and social connections. And they don't tempt only young slackers. In early 2016, for example, the Bronx High School of Science, home to some of New York City's highest-achieving students, began to shut off Wi-Fi access to students because their non-academic media streaming was slowing down the school's many bandwidth-intensive educational programs. In fact, digital distraction by smartphones and other devices is on the rise, both in high schools and in colleges. One study at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln found that on average, students spent 30% of their classroom time in non-educational electronic activity, from emails and social media to games. While all these activities can be pursued efficiently, many instructors believe distractions have made their teaching significantly less efficient. The problem is especially acute for students suffering from FOMO, fear of missing out, a syndrome that leads people to check compulsively for messages. The distraction, if not the passivity issue, extends to the workplace. One nonprofit consortium, the Information Overload Research Group, has calculated that American white-collar workers waste fully a quarter of their time on messages and notifications processed by multitasking, at a cost of nearly $1 trillion a year. Whether it's possible to justify this or any other number, sometimes an interruption can offer an opportunity, prevent a major loss, or make a new connection. There is no doubt that many people feel overwhelmed by data pushed on them through electronic devices. Banning smartphone use in classrooms is likely to have unintended negative consequences. Studies in Singapore and the United Kingdom suggest that many students with FOMO will learn less if entirely deprived. It is pointless to try to reverse the march of mobile communication. Even scholars concerned about their effect on relationships, conversation, and the capacity for solitude, like Sherry Turkle, don't propose restricting their use by the young, which would only increase their appeal as forbidden fruit. Paper may not address the social issues created by mobile technology, but it does add a creative and productive form of inefficiency that can promote greater efficiency in later life. In education, the choice between paper and digital media has become one of technology's wars of religion. Even in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, handwriting instruction was not monolithic. There have always been competing national traditions and methods. There were right and left-wing schools of handwriting instruction calling for disciplined uniformity on one side and expressive individualism on the other. In 21st century America, partisans of italic and cursive handwriting, as I discovered when I blogged on the subject, sometimes are fiercer toward each other than toward keyboard-only enthusiasts. Italic advocates especially object to equating all handwriting instruction with cursive. When most people think of connected school handwriting, though, they visualize some version of the late 19th and early 20th century Palmer method. Its goal was to train students in a uniform, rapid, legible script that would make them an efficient and regimented workforce in keeping with the teachings of gurus like Frederick Winslow Taylor. More recent research has shown that it is no more time-efficient than italic or even writing individual letters. Palmer method cursive handwriting was a form of continuous production of writing. While cursive instruction survived in the schools, the strict Palmer method was in sharp decline by the 1920s, made obsolescent by higher quality and lower priced typewriters. The main advantage of the typewriter over handwriting was not so much speed as uniformity and legibility, especially in large organizations exchanging documents among hundreds or thousands of employees. Since the 1920s, handwriting has ceased to be a commercial skill, and even its advantages in education have been used against it. Young people who do not learn to write rapidly and legibly, and their parents, protest with some justification that their examination scores are marked down unfairly. But what about typical children whose writing is neither illegible nor artistic? There is evidence from both neuroscience and psychology that handwriting, though slower than keyboarding, benefits learning. Karen Harmon James of Indiana University used a pretend spaceship to scan the brains of children who had learned to make letter forms and those who had not, using functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI. The former showed more adult thinking patterns than those who had learned only passive recognition of the alphabet. Laura Deinhardt, an educational psychologist at Florida International University, studied children from low-income families and found that those who became proficient at writing at an early age made better progress than those who had not. Forming letters and words, neuroscientists and psychologists believe, is more than a motor skill. It also involves thinking, language, and motor memory. In effect, it is a form of all-around mental exercise with benefits exceeding those of keyboarding alone. Skipping deliberate practice of writing and proceeding directly to keyboarding may save time and often frustration, but efficient short-term effort may make learning less efficient. The benefits of handwriting turn out to extend to older students and adults. It is reasonable to expect that undergraduates would be able to take better notes with a faster keyboard than with old-style notebooks. Experimental results a few years ago were thus surprising. Just as the apparently more cumbersome printed book was more efficient to comprehend than its electronic counterpart, students taking relatively inefficient handwritten notes score higher in examinations than those who use laptop computers, even when potentially distracting web surfing has been disabled. Psychologists recognize this paradox as efficiency with a phrase coined by the psychologists Elizabeth L. Bjork and Robert A. Bjork, desirable difficulty. Too much efficiency can impair our ability to form memories that will help us use information more efficiently later. Efficient isn't necessarily bad. It is often better to know how to retrieve information with a search engine than to spend time memorizing it. But if we want to learn something, research has shown, we have to make the effort hard enough if we want to retain it. It is almost as though there is, for the brain as well as muscles, an optimal level of resistance, just as there is in physical exercise. Students taking notes with laptops often copy the instructor's words as literally as possible, almost stenographically, as one reviewer put it. Because the handwritten note taker cannot keep up with the flow of words, he or she is constrained to identify and paraphrase the main ideas, and thus has a better chance of retaining them and mastering the course. The psychologists Pam Mueller and Daniel Oppenheimer performed a series of experiments with undergraduates to show how desirable difficulty affects classroom note-taking. All volunteers viewed TED Talks, video lectures of about 20 minutes, and were asked about them after completing a series of distracting tasks. Other computer functions, including the web, were disabled during the videos, so distraction was not an issue. As expected, students with laptops took significantly more detailed notes, but these did not seem to improve their test scores when examined either with or without a chance to review what they had written. One group of laptop subjects even was coached in note-taking technique and advised not to attempt a verbatim record. They had the opportunity to make the same kinds of notes as the longhand group, but more rapidly and in greater detail. This appears to have helped their recall of facts, but not their understanding of concepts. It is possible that the inefficiency of taking notes in longhand stimulates us to make every word count, to restate key ideas more concisely. Only by restating ideas in new ways can we be sure that we have understood them. Something about the inefficiency of handwriting constitutes desirable difficulty. A similar effect extends to the written word as well as to audiovisual presentation. Early 20th century modernist graphic designers and typographers shunned Victorian ornamentation and aspired to present ideas functionally. Already in 1928, the German master designer typographer Jan Tschichold cited the need of modern man to absorb every day a mass of printed matter which, whether he has asked for it or not, arrives every day through his letterbox. Information overload is hardly a new concept. Typography had to obey, as streamlined vehicle designs did, laws of economy, precision, minimum friction. In other words, efficiency. In bold type, sans serif, of course, Tschichold declared, "The essence of the new typography," the title of his book, "is clarity." He later retreated from this work's radical viewpoint, and from the Berthold Foundry's spare 1898 font, Occidens Grotesque, he had used, and designed a more traditional and still popular font, Sabon. In the 21st century, clarity is prized aesthetically, but its value in promoting efficient reading is much less clear. Comparing the performance of undergraduates whose classes had been randomly assigned texts in a variety of fonts, Mueller and Oppenheimer found that those with fonts considered least legible showed greatest comprehension. One was the despised Comic Sans. A second was a display font, Hattenschweiler, notoriously illegible as a text font. They were compared with the sans-serif type Arial. With both Princeton University volunteer subjects and Ohio high school students, comprehension was greatest using the disfluent fonts. Inefficient reading somehow led to more effective learning. We should not make too much of this paper, widely noted in the popular press, because there is such a range of disfluency, and its effects depend on culture. Modern Germans, educated with Roman typefaces, find the 19th-century Fraktur, sometimes called Gothic in the English-speaking world, difficult to read, but it was perfectly natural to their ancestors, who had absorbed it in their first school lessons. One of the disfluent fonts in the study, Corsiva, is based on the beautiful chancery hand of the Renaissance, first developed by papal secretaries, the opposite of Comic Sans. Disfluency still has limits. Even if students will understand a professor's ideas best if these are formatted in a non-standard font, like Trebuchet, it does not follow that a student's paper will be best appreciated in it. Georgia seems to be the safest choice, because it was commissioned by Microsoft from the illustrious typographer Matthew Carter to be equally legible on screen and in laser and inkjet printing. A professor reading it on screen will see nearly the same thing as one who reads it on paper. And some professions are so used to older fonts that any substitution would induce rejection, not closer reading. Ever since the days of the IBM Selectric, the public domain font IBM commissioned for its standard golf ball head, 12-point courier, is still de rigueur for Hollywood and television scripts, partly because of the happy accident that one page of it equals about a minute of production time. Innovation in screenwriting fonts is almost entirely limited to tweaks in courier, and even some of these may not be acceptable. So it seems to be a rule that while acquiring new information is done most efficiently with a bit of optimal difficulty, the designer's old adage applies. The best font is the one that is unnoticed, as indeed Times Roman was known only to newspaper people and typographic professionals before Macintosh and PostScript introduced the masses to font literacy. The greatest experiment in educational efficiency is neither font design nor the technology of lecture notes. It is the attempt to substitute screens for print. In the 1980s and 1990s, I was one of many commentators mocking the idea of the paperless office and pointing out that the new efficiency of laser printing was enabling people to generate more print documents than ever, even though a dwindling proportion of all information was being distributed on paper. Yet contrary to my prediction of continued growth, the world appears to have reached a peak of paper consumption in 2013. For years, efficiency seemed to be on the side of screens over paper. In 2009, Jacob Weisberg, editor of the online magazine Slate, who had a few years before called for an iPod of reading, declared that Amazon's newly released Kindle 2 reader signals that after a happy 550-year union, reading and printing are getting separated. It tells us that printed books, the most important artifacts of human civilization, are going to join newspapers and magazines on the road to obsolescence. A few years later, in 2012, Secretary of Education Arne Duncan joined in, declaring in a speech to the National Press Club that, over the next few years, textbooks should be obsolete, replaced by tablets and educational websites. But the question remained, would a new generation turn from print books as they had from musical recordings on physical media? E-books seemed to have almost every advantage, except for being licenses rather than physical media that can be resold freely, over paper books. Manufacturing paper in rolls rather than as individual sheets was, as we have heard in Chapter 1, a foundation of the age of continuous process technology. The e-book, which may reside temporarily in a device's memory, but which in principle can never be lost or destroyed as long as there is a master on a server, appears a miracle of efficiency. It spares the environmental damage of papermaking, leaving open the effects of rare earth mining and electronic waste disposal, avoids the cost of transportation and warehousing, and is not subject to the inventory taxes that had been blamed for so many books going out of print in the 1980s. It can be searched even without a conventional index, highlighted and annotated temporarily without damaging the base image, and stored so compactly that a small library can be carried in a briefcase or purse. Even the relatively low-fidelity computer displays of the late 1980s and early 1990s, decades before Amazon Kindle, seemed to threaten print culture. The digital future, feared by critics like Theodore Rozsák in The Cult of Information and Sven Burkertz in The Gutenberg Elegies, seemed to be coming true. The reality since Weisberg's original column has been coexistence of general interest books, not the rapid triumph of readers and tablets that enthusiasts expected. The question for both digital advocates and traditionalists, however, was less about the habits of current readers than those of the rising generation, who have indeed deserted some print media like newspapers. But the reasons for their choices have not always been clear. Was it the act of reading documents in a broadsheet or tabloid format? Was it the increasing prices of newspapers after platform competition and electronic classifieds began to siphon off advertising revenue? Was it the style and mix of reporting? College students' textbook preferences are a clearer gauge of youth's information habits. And to the surprise of the digital prophets, young people are media omnivores, pragmatists, who see value in both paper and screens. They were not alone. Sales of physical books increased from slightly under 520 million copies in 2012, when Duncan made his prediction, to 571 million books by the beginning of the Christmas season in 2015. Even when a free digital download of a textbook is available, one study showed, a quarter of students buy a physical copy. Further academic research revealed why people aged 18 to 30 still love print. Inspired inefficiency is a familiar concept to them. Naomi Barron, a linguistics professor specializing in reading habits, has found that students often cite better comprehension in slower, paper-based reading. Independent bookstores report a student preference for print, and Barron's research suggests that if digital editions were not cheaper, paper would be the strong student favorite. Just as Pam Mueller and Daniel Oppenheimer helped explain why more detailed electronic notes are less efficient for mastering lectures than handwritten notes, other psychologists have probed the kind of advantages that Barron students have found in digital and print formats, which turn out to be complementary. A study by the reading specialists Anne Mangan and Jean-Luc Vellet compared comprehension of a fictional work on Amazon's Kindle reader and in a paperback. In all but one category, print readers scored higher than screen readers. The human factors researchers, Jeff Kaufman and Mary Flanagan, found that readers acquired information differently when reading the same fictional material on screens and as hard copy. Reading on electronic devices improves recall of details in quizzes. Reading printed text is less efficient for learning specifics, but more so for understanding a work more broadly. Subjects who saw information on electronic devices were better at low-level recall, but those who saw the same data in print were better able to execute the higher-level why, as opposed to the lower-level how of a task. Even in games simulating real-life professional decisions, Kaufman and Flanagan discovered in a separate study, participants perceived the analog version as simpler and were more responsive to the game's goal of changing attitudes. This response to simulations suggests that the printed book, or newspaper, or magazine, is not just a material object for transmitting text and illustrations. It is also a three-dimensional space that we explore as we read. That does not necessarily mean that, for example, to understand Charles Dickens, we should wait eagerly for each installment as the first 19th-century readers of his novels did, or that we should read Jane Austen in her original three-volume format that inflated the text for the lending library market. That is strictly for bibliophiles and library scholars. But all formats of print shape our experience of the text. They leave bookmarks as signposts. A book is not just an object, but a terrain. When we read a printed book, we remember a text more meaningfully because we are visiting a place. Chances are you remember actually handling books by Dr. Seuss, Maurice Sendak, and other great children's authors when you were growing up. Reading researchers have found that young children prefer to read print rather than electronic versions with their parents, and the topographic experience is probably a major reason. Because of this and other effects, studies by psychologists and comments by students on print and electronic media seem to converge on one metaphor used by Kaufman and Flanagan, the forest and the trees. Not only for mature adults who turned to electronic media after the age of 30, but even for younger people who grew up with screen information, there is a consistent pattern. Electronic formats are more efficient for studying and grasping details, and incomparably more efficient when searching for information one already knows for review or further study. Print formats, partly because they seem to demand more careful reading, are better suited to grasping larger ideas. There is no point to arguing the merits of the two formats. Book sales patterns show that some kind of balance is likely to persist. Barron's research may also have revealed what happened to the electronic tutoring projects of the later 20th century. The goal of individualized instruction has not gone away, especially in science and mathematics. It survives in the online resources included with many textbook packages, accessible to buyers of print and electronic editions alike, but better integrated with the latter. Edison had dreamed of replacing inefficient paper texts with audiovisual materials. Skinner had imagined programmed machines. The personal computer and the web have enabled the textbook industry to take the place of dedicated terminals like Plato's, but there has been a catch. Although Edison and Skinner conceived of technological instruction as a more economically efficient alternative to traditional methods, the cost of the resources is now charged to student buyers of textbooks. An economics professor at North Carolina State University recently published an essay in the Wall Street Journal claiming that the $250 Amazon price, $360 list of one leading economics textbook he was considering reflected a rate of inflation 6 times higher than that of the Consumer Price Index. His own excellent introductory text in the early 1980s had cost less than a tenth of that amount. The price, he argued, showed the inefficiency of the market in texts. The professors who decide on text adoption don't pay for the books, while the students may accept the prices because they are small compared to their tuition bills. Other professors dispute charges of excessive pricing. The sociologist Joshua Kim, for example, believes that texts costing hundreds of dollars can be fair value because of their included audiovisual aids for lecturers and personalized exercises for students. Whoever is right, the point is the same. Whether educational efficiency means more rapid learning or less expense for students, more efficient technology has not only failed to replace textbooks, as Thomas Edison had hoped. New electronic technologies have helped increase, rather than reduce, the cost of instructional materials. Beyond lectures, notes, and textbooks, there is another side of education that receives less attention because it is harder to measure and often reveals its benefits slowly. The ability to ask questions beyond the assignments, to search for and recognize the best information, to make original observations, to debate and collaborate, and to produce new ideas. Silicon Valley's cult of the dropout is based on the accusation that colleges fail to teach just such things. And where information technology's detractors see personal computers and the web leading down the garden path to endless distraction, its champions see them empowering creativity. The problem of the rise of the smartphone for education is that it is highly efficient for consuming media, but less than ideal for creativity and experimentation. According to child development researchers, the effects can be positively harmful to small children who are still building the neural networks of their brains. We have evolved to need a variety of stimuli from infancy to the age of 3. The delight of very young children with the stimulation of smartphones appears to many parents a sign of engagement and rapid mental growth. The small screen is super efficient in responding to the child's curiosity. Yet the psychologist Arik Sigman has called excessive screen time the very thing impeding the development of the abilities that parents are so eager to foster through the tablets, harming the ability to focus, to concentrate, to lend attention, to sense other people's attitudes and communicate with them, to build a large vocabulary. Frank R. Wilson, a neurologist, has gone further, deploring the decline of physical play as contrary to the crucial role of the hand in developing the human brain. For influential enthusiasts of mobile computing, like the Wired magazine editorial director Robert Capps, smartphones are unleashing a new age of networked creativity, thanks to our ability to upload photographs, videos, and posts to Facebook and other sharing sites. The smartphone's integration with the self, Capps declares, makes it our partner in how we express ourselves, in what we hold out as beautiful and compelling, in how we try to emotionally connect, in ways abstract and literal, with our friends and muses. And while it is easy to cite antisocial examples in all these genres, it's hard to deny that some viral creations indeed deserve their renown. It is no longer unusual for prestigious art galleries to sponsor exhibitions of cell phone photography. Still, even large-format smartphones are small canvases, hardly ideal for composing music, making a drawing suitable for publication, or even editing photographs beyond the admittedly copious filters available in apps. The economics of Apple, which made its reputation in part by specializing in computers for graphic designers and musicians, invert its former priorities. Only 10% of the company's revenue comes from desktop and laptop machines. 3/4 comes from iPhones and iPads. Some of Apple's decisions have disappointed advanced professionals in the arts and graphics. Wired's reviewer found that Microsoft's all-in-one Surface Studio with a 28-inch ultra-high-density monitor seemed irresistible to the magazine's designers. In December 2017, Apple responded by launching its most powerful desktop computer, the iMac Pro, and promised a new version of its flagship Mac Pro in 2018. It's hard to imagine composing a short story, much less a novel, on a smartphone or tablet without a separate keyboard. So no matter what mobile computing can do for creativity in education, it enforces a bias toward the small canvas. Equally challenging to creativity in education is the smartphone's promise of unending novelty. Part of learning, in fact, of adult life, has always been productive boredom. Smartphones, in themselves, don't necessarily dictate overstimulation. There are even free apps for meditation. But they do offer instant relief from tedium, and that is not necessarily a good thing. The artist-philosopher Saul Steinberg once remarked that the life of the creative man is led, directed, and controlled by boredom. Avoiding boredom is one of our most important purposes. Relieving boredom with free thought can be a far more efficient way of using time than playing a game or watching a video. There is no doubt that students are much more likely to use smartphones to avoid boredom. According to a 2015 report by the Pew Research Center, fully 93% of smartphone owners aged 18 to 29 did so, as opposed to 55% of those over 50. Those younger smartphone owners are also more likely to report themselves distracted or angry, as well as grateful. The survey apparently did not ask about the objects of those emotions. Sometimes, relieving boredom does promote efficiency. Time spent waiting in line at supermarkets and airports need not be lost. But smartphones are still most efficient when receiving information rather than generating longer original work. Their small screens are actually more efficient than large monitors for reading most social media feeds. Scrolling with finger swipes is more natural than working with keys and a mouse. Long-time readers of online publications have also discovered that many sites are now optimized, as I suggested in Chapter 1, for mobile rather than desktop or laptop devices, which in turn helps drive users to the former. The ubiquity of cell phones also reflects the high cost of home broadband service for many low-income families. The Pew Report notes the disturbing trend that a significant number of young people have internet access only through their smartphones. This puts them at a significant educational disadvantage, especially in reading and creating longer documents. Another kind of paradoxical efficiency also has been magnified by the smartphone, the challenge to declarative memory, the information that we can summon instantly. Defenders of information technology have for decades cited Plato's concern that writing was endangering memory, and there has recently been a revival of memory training techniques and even memorization as a competitive sport. The psychologist Anders Ericsson's pathbreaking work on expertise was his discovery that, with conscious practice, average people could memorize strings of letters far longer than what his fellow psychologists had assumed were natural limits of 9 or 10 characters. U.S. telephone numbers and area codes were based in part on Bell Laboratories' research on memory capacity, which established a 7-digit optimum for local numbers. It is obvious that information technology users in general, and smartphone users in particular, keep large amounts of significant data either in local device memory or in cloud storage like Gmail accounts. Even relatively primitive hardware, like inexpensive desk telephones, has to be able to store dozens of names and numbers in memory. It is not surprising that psychologists have found that people who know they will be able to retrieve information easily will be less likely to remember it. The mind prioritizes, and it's a good thing, too. Passwords, security experts keep reminding us, should be as randomized and hard to remember as possible. But we should also not leave them on a sticky note attached to the monitor or carry a list around. Even when using a mnemonic system to create relatively secure passwords, most people need too many of them to remember which belongs to which site. And the same security professionals also advise us not to use the same login for two accounts and to change all passwords regularly. It does not seem a loss to outsource such data, even friends' telephone numbers that were once memorized. Recently, the developer of the most influential password guidelines, Bill Burr, has recanted his original advice, recommending long passphrases of actual words instead. But many or most sites will not yet accept them. Technologically extended memory still can create inefficiency through efficiency. Because information of all kinds is so easy to retrieve, we are losing not just routine lists, but essential facts that we need to evaluate and assimilate new information. Summarizing academic research on the technological augmentation of memory, the writer Sophie McBain found that a bias for reliance on electronic memory risks promoting intellectual complacency, making people less curious about new information because they feel they already know it, and less likely to pay attention to detail because our computers are remembering it. Without a framework for assessing new information, we are less able to deal with it efficiently. Young people may be no more ignorant than their parents and grandparents, but the mobile web and social media give them a false sense of knowledge less common in earlier generations, when looking up a fact beyond the scope of an almanac or entry-level home encyclopedia meant a trip to the local public library. As we have already heard, strongly polarized identity has weakened the power of facts. People confronted with facts that tend to undermine their point of view don't modify their outlook, they strengthen it. A classic case, studied by the psychologist Leon Festinger, was the Chicago religious movement of the 1950s, whose leader predicted the end of the world on a certain date. When the prophecy failed, followers did not quit in disillusionment, but agreed with their leader that God had spared the world in recognition of their faith. The web is not completely neutral in this post-fact tendency, which affects both students and adults. It is not just a stream of messages like traditional media, but a cultural and political arsenal with resources to support almost any point of view. In fact, the algorithms of search engines are efficient at detecting the kind of sites that users are looking for. If students and others were more aware of the limits of their knowledge, they might search more carefully and deliberately. They might look for the strongest evidence and arguments challenging their viewpoints, if only to rebut them more decisively. But this would require them to have much of the very knowledge that they are seeking, a new version of Meno's paradox. Wikipedia is a partial solution to search results distorted either by widespread misinformation, like most conspiracy theories, or by systematic manipulation of search algorithms. The best articles have links to high-quality sources, but many others do not. And Wikipedia articles, precisely because they are written collectively, are much better as reference sources than as learning tools. Entries on technical topics present comprehensive up-to-date details, such as specifications of audio and video standards and formats, that no printed work could keep current. The openness of Wikipedia to public editing allows for instantaneous correction. It's a lifesaver for scientific and technical professionals and advanced students, and for others with readily answered questions like technical standards and specifications. The strengths of Wikipedia's system nonetheless become weaknesses when novices try to study with it. Writing a clear explanation of a scientific concept for newcomers is an art because of the curse of knowledge, as we have discussed. At its best, the conventional print encyclopedia reflected a respected point of view and teaching style. Editors were experienced in helping contributors clarify wording for beginners. The disadvantage was that the revision cycle, especially in the late 20th century, could barely keep up with new knowledge on many topics, and annual yearbooks were no substitute. The co-founder of Wikipedia, Larry Sanger, an academic, unlike his more colorful, globe-trotting ex-colleague Jimmy Wales, became unhappy with the inconsistent quality of the project and the sometimes raucous culture of anonymous editors, and launched an alternative called Citizendium, in which contributors published their real names and accepted guidance from experts and editors. Citizendium was an experiment to determine whether volunteer free culture spirit could coexist with traditional ideas of quality control. By 2017, after 10 years, the venture appeared troubled. While Citizendium maintained its website and announced forthcoming articles, its official statistics page stopped at 2014, and even for that year showed under 10 active contributors each day. It was even difficult to find a list of approved articles online. The lesson of both Wikipedia and Citizendium seems to be that experts and lay volunteers don't mix. If the latter dominate, most of the former will leave. But if the latter must submit to the former, both groups become unhappy and the project falters. Professionalism and populism rarely coexist. There is thus no viable free alternative to Wikipedia. There is a partial solution to the limits of general search engines and the Wikipedia articles that are at or near the top of their responses. So-called federated search engines available in libraries index many of the dozens of databases and hundreds or thousands of electronic journals to which a library may subscribe, including the vast back-issue files of the JSTOR Academic Journal Database. These may include good explanatory articles from online specialized encyclopedias. Students often prefer them, but their search results omit important resources that may be included in those of Google. Students also are overconfident in their online skills. The ease of using Google, Bing, and other major search engines hides the implicit choices that search engine algorithms are making. Few students use the advanced search options of Google, even though Google itself offers web pages for searcher education. Librarians find that the structure of student searches also reflects a misunderstanding of how ranking works, sometimes almost magical thinking. To find a good book on a topic, they will enter "good book on" without understanding that authoritative recommendations probably don't contain the phrase "good book." Students are thus subject to a form of the Dunning-Kruger effect, believing they fit the positive media stereotype of the digital native, intuitively fluent in all forms of information technology. Media studies researchers say they have a lot to learn. Siva Vaidhyanathan, author of The Googleization of Everything, told The Chronicle of Higher Education that the digital native idea is a myth in the direct interest of education technology companies and Silicon Valley itself. The notion of the technological savant-like talent of the young, he said, encourages policies and buying decisions and pedagogical decisions that pander to Silicon Valley. And the technology writer and computer manual author David Pogue has observed that while many people have come to believe that all software questions can be readily answered by search, the decline of printed technical guides has left users unaware of many features buried within desktop software programs that could save them time and frustration. Silicon Valley's mistake is not in developing efficient algorithms from which we all benefit, but in encouraging the illusion that algorithms can and should function in the absence of